Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. If you're at work listening to this program, chances are you're being watched. Even if there's not a boss or colleague physically breathing down your neck, a growing array of software allows your employer to monitor your every move, tracking your speed and seatbelt use in a company-owned vehicle, and noting every click and keystroke on your computer. Developers of these real-time tools insist they can enhance safety and productivity and cut down on the theft by workers of both time and company assets. As my guest has discovered, though, all these electronic eyes are fundamentally changing the nature of work for both managers and the staff they supervise, and in some cases they result in workers putting in hours they will never get paid for. Esther Kaplan is editor of the Investigation Fund at the Nation Institute. Her article, The Spy Who Fired Me, The Human Costs of Workplace Monitoring, is the cover story for the March issue of Harper's Magazine. Esther, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
Is there any limit to the kind of data employers are allowed to collect regarding their workers while they are at work?
There is almost none. There are no federal regulations that touch this at all in the workplace. And there are only two states, and I'm sorry, one of them is not Texas, that regulate it at all or even require disclosure, just Delaware and Connecticut. This is highly regulated, by the way, throughout Europe. So the United States is a bit of an outlier here in giving companies free rein to do as they like in terms of monitoring their employees.
So it sounds like a lot of people listening right now could be monitored by their employers and not have been alerted to this in any way.
Exactly. That's exactly right. I mean, it is considered best practice to let your employees know that they are being monitored or that software has been installed on their computer that's going to monitor their internet use or their instant messages or their emails. But it's absolutely not required. And I think chances are many people out there are being monitored without knowing about it.
And whatever we do, whatever we search, whatever we upload to a company computer, even if it's like pictures of our kids on the soccer field, typically is considered property of the company once it goes on that machine.
Exactly. So there's no limits there, both in monitoring the network of contacts you might reach out to and the actual content of those photos, those emails, those Facebook posts.
Is the idea that monitoring keeps people from wasting company time, like watching YouTube videos or shopping or whatever they do?
Yeah, there's clearly a real obsession with time theft. Some of the systems are for hourly workers are set up to make sure using thumb scans, for example, that they are themselves clocking in and clocking out, that they don't leave early and have a buddy punch them out. And then in terms of office workers, people working on a computer, yeah, that you're not spending your time shopping for that birthday present or checking the weather, that you're on task at all time. And in fact, in some cases that your keystrokes, your mouse clicks, you know, the number of calls you're handling if you're a call center worker are hitting really specific metrics.
What kind of online behavior looks productive to a manager of knowledge workers?
Well, so as knowledge has begun to be viewed as a corporate asset, there's been a lot of attention paid into both, the positive side here would be how do you cultivate knowledge in your employees? How do you encourage them to share that knowledge within their department and beyond? The monitoring tends to be sort of social network monitoring. So you're looking at how often someone is, say, emailing or instant messaging or communicating or calling people within their department, outside of their department, colleagues outside of the country, and getting a sense of how networked they are. If they've created a PowerPoint, how often their colleagues are looking at that PowerPoint. So it's centered around trying to measure and quantify knowledge sharing.
It seems like the kind of thing that companies would be aware of based on the output that workers are creating rather than by whatever input they're doing on their devices.
Well, that's the traditional style of management, and it's not clear yet, I think, in this realm that these new software systems, these workforce management systems, talent management systems, they have all kinds of monikers, are actually producing the results that they're intended to. Even one of the firms that I looked at called Cornerstone, in one of their corporate reports, they actually said there is no generally accepted model for or standard set of metrics for measuring return on investment. This is kind of an experimental, brave new world, but the adoption is happening very, very quickly nevertheless in a sort of keep up with the Joneses kind of way. If other people are adopting these systems, we should be adopting these systems. These systems are the state of the art. And I think how exactly they play out and whether companies really get that return on investment, even from their own perspective, is not totally clear. They're not cheap systems.
I was thinking about this, and I'm sure you can relate. I realize that lots of different jobs have different requirements, but like I can spend the morning writing, and my fingers are only on the keyboard typing out words for maybe a quarter of the time that I'm working to write something.
Right. Well, the scholars who study electronic monitoring tend to say that the more complex a job is, the less clear it is that the monitoring actually effectively increases productivity. So if it's a very rote task that you're doing, let's say you're doing data inputting, that monitoring can kind of function to hurry people up and get them to type more words per minute. But that when it's more complex tasks, and you know, even navigating a delivery truck in dense traffic in a city is complicated enough, but certainly a creative process like writing, that the monitoring can actually interfere with your productivity because there's this piece of your brain that's focused on the fact that you're being monitored. And obviously all of that kind of intangible thought work, or you know, pulling a book off the shelf and looking for a reference, all of that kind of stuff evades these technologies. And so you begin to get to a question of what happens to all that important stuff that can't be measured, and do companies start reorienting all kinds of decisions about promotion, hiring, firing, and so on around what is measurable, which doesn't capture exactly the kind of work you just described.
This is fascinating. What drew your attention to this subject in the first place was a change in the kind of service you were getting from UPS. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, well, right. So I live in New York City in an apartment building, and I don't have a doorman. So I'm kind of dependent on leaving these, you know, hand-scrawled notes on the door saying, if I'm not here, please leave the package at the laundromat. And it never worked. And then I found that even when I was home, I would still get that attempted delivery note instead of actually receiving the package. And when I started talking with folks involved in at UPS and organizers involved with UPS workers, I realized that it really might have to do with the electronic monitoring system that's been in place there called telematics. UPS was kind of a pioneer in this field. And so they've got a system where each delivery truck has 200 sensors, and the driver has a handheld device with additional sensors. And so whereas once upon a time in the old days, what drivers used to do when they were getting to the end of their shift and hadn't been able to make deliveries is they would just mark attempted deliveries down on a sheet. And supervisors, in fact, coached them to do this so that they wouldn't have to record missed deliveries. But now that those GPS devices can tell UPS whether they're at your address when they mark an attempted delivery. So they have to at least get there. But do they have to wait for the few minutes for you to come downstairs and answer the doorbell and sign for the package? Or do they want to take those extra minutes to go across the street to deliver it to the laundromat instead? Probably not when they're being measured when, you know, really every moment in their day is being measured, and they have this incredibly tight quota for every package delivery and a higher and higher load of package deliveries. So since UPS instituted this system, over the course of the years that they did, domestic package delivery increased by almost 1.5 million, and they actually delivered those packages with at least 1,000 fewer drivers. So each driver's workload just increased and increased and increased, and they had to find ways to cut corners. And they cut corners on these attempted deliveries. They cut corners on their own safety in terms of they're not able to go through the processes to lift a box safely. They're not crossing streets on a green light to deliver packages. They're not, they're finding workarounds for their seatbelt compliance. So, you know, there's a question of increasing people's productivity, and then there's a question of, well, at what point are you pushing that productivity measure so hard that there's all these unforeseen consequences?
It's telling that something as simple as clicking on a seatbelt takes so much extra time in the minds of at least some drivers that this is something they're going to try to work around by, like, leaving it buckled all day so that they don't have to mess with it and the truck doesn't turn them in for not having their seatbelt on.
Well, I looked at one of these. I got a someone shared with me a screen capture of what these telematics reports look like to a supervisor, and they're able to see the truck, you know, moving through the street, and for each package delivery, there's a number that's rising and falling. It's their over under number. Are they under their time quota? Are they over their time quota? And each package, and you've got hundreds and hundreds of packages a day. It's about more than 100 stops per day, and each stop might have 5, 10, 20 packages. For each package, you have this quota, and you're basically every driver is going over their quota by 2 to 3 hours a day and getting reprimanded for it. So every place where they can run a yellow light or jaywalk or do whatever they have to do to save, you know, 20 seconds on that package, 30 seconds on the other package, that's the only way they're going to stay within shouting distance of these really strict quotas.
And, of course, if they happen to have an oversized package that requires them to get a dolly out or something, that's going to take more time. Are allowances made for that sort of thing?
I mean, I think that UPS would say they are, and they do sometimes actually send supervisors out for ride-alongs to observe drivers directly on their routes and look at how much time things really take. But all the drivers that I spoke with said that the quotas are just completely unrealistic. They're being told on the one hand to follow all of these safety rules, and on the other hand being given time quotas that require them to skip almost all of those practices.
One guy told you he doesn't even have time to, like, safely lift from the legs because he's got to just book that stuff to the door.
Yeah, and I talked to a labor organizer who just said, you know, the number of people, I heard this from drivers too, the number of people who've blown out their shoulders, their knees, their backs, you know, these are guys, you know, by the time they're in their 40s, their bodies look, you know, they look like they've been playing pro football their whole lives or something. They're just so beaten up from the intense physical demands of the job.
Esther Kaplan is my guest. She's editor of the Investigation Fund at the Nation Institute, and she wrote the cover story for the March issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called The Spy Who Fired Me, The Human Costs of Workplace Monitoring. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning. With classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules, applications are now being accepted for the program beginning April 6th. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Esther Kaplan, who's editor of the Investigation Fund at the Nation Institute and who wrote the cover story for the March issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called The Spy Who Fired Me, The Human Costs of Workplace Monitoring. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Esther, I want to get back to this idea that monitoring is fundamentally changing the nature of management. Bosses today spend less time observing and interacting with the human beings they supervise and more time sifting through the accumulated data designed to document performance for them.
Yeah, this was one of the aspects of the story that I found really fascinating is what is this doing to the kind of frontline manager who maybe used to have real relationships with people and now is just overwhelmed with this flood of data they don't even really know what to do with. And we talked about telematics as this system that UPS uses. It's now beginning to be adopted more broadly by all kinds of commercial vehicle fleets. And I went to a fleet managers conference at one point in Minneapolis, and I went to a number of sessions where all of these fleet managers, again, frontline level managers, were just talking about how they've got these systems now, they've got this massive flow of data, and they really don't know how to sort through it all and make sense of it and turn it into useful information. And meanwhile, and this is supported by surveys, their drivers are in rebellion over suddenly being monitored in this intensive way. So it's a kind of wrenching transformation that's going on, both for employees and for frontline managers. And, little remarked on, really, this gigantic transformation of work that's going on.
And, of course, a good manager who is good at working with the people she supervises maybe recognizes that, you know, employee A is fantastic, but his mom has been ill, so this week you need to cut him some slack. But if you can only rely on the data to report on your employees, you suddenly lose a lot of autonomy.
Well, I think that if a manager's pretty grounded and, you know, has that kind of perspective, they can probably maintain those relationships. I think the problem is that those data points, and especially the ones that kind of get elevated by the company as like those key KPI, a key performance indicator, the thing that we're all being judged on, can change people's approach. And I looked at McDonald's, for example, and in places like fast food and retail, that key number is the ratio of revenue to labor costs, and it's calculated as frequently as every 15 minutes throughout the course of the day. And whereas there was always pressure to keep labor costs down, now the fact that managers have this number popping up that they're supposed to check constantly. One scholar who's been studying this transformation in retail told me that managers had described it to her as almost the way we're addicted to email now. We didn't, however many years ago, we didn't have email. Now we have to check it every second of the day. And that's how they feel about that labor metric, that they have to be on top of it from the moment they arrive till the moment they leave. And they're constantly warning all their employees, I may have to let someone leave early. And there's this sort of sense of insecurity that pervades the whole operation that's created by these metrics that really wasn't there to the same degree before these systems were implemented.
It seems reasonable that companies who have this software might use it if they had reason to suspect that an employee was, you know, not really working up to par or was sort of deliberately creating some kind of, committing malfeasance or whatever. But having to use this to monitor everybody's performance all the time, it does seem like it could be used. Anybody's data could be interpreted in such a way that makes them look either really good or really bad.
Yeah, I think that's the fear that employees now live with who are working within these systems. That, you know, I take a bathroom break that's too long and I'm going to get hauled in front of my supervisor. So there's this enormous correlation of these systems with a spike in stress on the part of people trying to work within them. And then, of course, stress has all these other very real physical consequences, from back pain to shoulder pain to repetitive stress injuries to depression to anxiety to sleep problems. So, I think it's really a challenge. And, of course, all of the companies that offer these kinds of services can offer up those stories where, yeah, it turned out that this person was doing her PhD thesis when she was supposed to be transcribing, and we caught it and we let her go and we saved all that money. And, you know, that's a happy ending for the company. But the problem is that if the majority of your workforce was doing their job, was committed, and now they have this incredible sense of being watched, being observed, being judged in this really minute way, as opposed to being trusted to make judgment calls, it can erode a lot of human relationships that actually drive people and motivate people to do their jobs well.
Another thing you discovered was at the retail level, where managers are being pressured to keep labor costs down, they're having to resort to a lot of things that perhaps they'd prefer not to do, like telling employees to clock out temporarily and sort of take an unpaid break while they wait for business to pick up again. But the employees aren't like really free to leave. It's not as if they're truly off.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a few lawsuits against McDonald's right now about these practices, and they're probably in violation of federal labor law. You can't really have people not on the clock but required to be present. You have to be paying them for those hours if they're required to be at work, available to work, on site for work. So I think McDonald's view is they have all of these franchises and there's sort of a layer of deniability. They aren't telling individual stores how to manage things. They're just telling them to keep their labor costs low. But, you know, when I talk to people who were shift managers who are actually in charge of managing that stuff, I mean, they would talk about such lean staffing that over the course of, say, an overnight shift, there was literally not time for anyone to even go to the bathroom. And yet, to keep labor costs down, you know, being instructed to go into the system and clock people out for an hour-long unpaid lunch break that, you know, never was taken, and that anyone who was ever there on a night shift would know that no one on staff during those hours was ever able to take a real break like that. So it's this elevation of a key metric to the point where you drive all kinds of unintended consequences. I think we've seen that to some extent in the introduction of high-stakes testing into our public schools and all these cheating scandals. You know, there's a trial going on about Atlanta cheating right now where teachers and principals and superintendents just felt like they have to meet that metric, so they start breaking the rules to do it. And these systems facilitate that kind of thinking.
Yeah, it's almost like they cause us not to trust our own instinct and understanding mm-hmm. of human nature, which most people have a pretty good sense of.
Yeah, well, we're at a time where technological change is happening so quickly. And I think that we are all a bit enamored of what technology can offer us. And it's tricky sometimes for people to actually be skeptical of what it can offer us. I think these systems are obviously tremendously powerful, and they could be utilized in a way that was integrated with these other concerns and integrated with the needs of the workforce as well. They're powerful enough to pull in all kinds of factors. But so far, you know, they haven't really been designed in a way that helps us avoid these kinds of problems.
And they're not necessarily designed by people who actually are doing this sort of work. I mean, you could be a brilliant mm-hmm. software designer and you could have a bunch of data points that you know you want to cover, but not factor in, you know, the reality that if you're a McDonald's cash register employee and you take 10 extra seconds to smile and joke with somebody, that you may build a customer for life, whereas if you're incredibly curt, they may decide to go to the Wendy's down the street.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that is beginning to be a discussion, I think, in this retail world, is all of the missed, what they call opportunity costs, that are not measured. So whereas you can measure that you're translating this much foot traffic into this many sales and you have this many people on staff to do it, you can't measure as easily the person who comes in and waits so long to get assistance from a salesperson that they just bail. That isn't picked up by the metrics in the same way because that person never interacts with the cash register, which is pulling in the data, right? And so there's beginning to be an awareness that you have to take those sorts of lost opportunities into account, as well as these easily measurable data inputs. And we'll see how that evolves in the coming years if these systems get smarter.
We have an email here to think@kera.org from Kevin, who says, I worked in a UPS sorting facility back in the late 70s. The driver's jobs were very desirable then because they were the only ones that could not be monitored in the way you're talking about. Obviously, that has changed. Our quota when loading and unloading trucks was 1,200 packages per hour in or out of the truck. That's one package every 3 seconds, and the job nearly killed me. No job. Now my job security is in security, and one of my duties is to control access in and out of the facility where I work. We recently instituted a policy which slows the UPS drivers down a few seconds when delivering at our club. I feel sorry for them, but it's my job to control access. We've gotten into a number of confrontations. We both understand the other guy's point of view, but we are both under pressure from our bosses. Interesting situation there.
That is really interesting. I mean, this is what I was hearing from the drivers I was talking to is, you know, once upon a time when they'd show up for, say, a package pickup, they could, you know, chat for a bit with people there and kind of have a little, you know, human moment while someone finished addressing a package. And now if the package isn't like absolutely ready to hand over the minute they arrive, their instruction is to just leave. And I'm sure plenty of conflicts have arisen around that kind of stuff as well. And again, this is one of those things that's not going to show up in the metrics, but will it eventually show up in customer loyalty, in lost revenue, you know, over a longer period of time? It might. And again, the danger of these systems, both from the corporate perspective and the employee perspective, is all of that stuff that they are not capturing and drawing our attention only to what is capturable with the data.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Joshua on the line in Arlington. Hey, Joshua.
Hello. I'm curious to know in your research if you've described already the, I guess, abuse of workers and the suffering they experience as an effect of these monitoring systems. And I'm wondering if you saw any difference between those experiences of workers who were unionized and those who were not?
Yeah, huge differences, actually. I mean, that's part of what makes it interesting how these systems are being implemented and how they could be implemented. Because, for example, I looked at a lot of non-unionized retail stores where, you know, this system gets implemented and almost the entire workforce gets thrown into part-time work, no benefits, no predictability of their schedules. They need to be on call at all times. And then you go to a unionized store. I looked at this one called Century 21 in New York, which sells discount high-end fashion. And they were unionized. So the company instituted one of these very popular systems. It's called Kronos. And the same thing happened. All their full-time workforce all got suddenly thrown onto part-time shifts and unpredictable shifts where they previously had 40-hour work weeks that were standardized they could build their lives around. And the union fought back. I mean, they filed grievances. They filed federal labor charges, and they got the company to sit down at the negotiating table, and they created ground rules. And now anyone with 10 years seniority gets a fixed full-time schedule. And there are other constraints that they put in place around the chaos that the systems could kind of inflict on the workforce. So one of the things that I think is important to understand about this trend is a lot of these systems really have been adopted and developed just over the last 7 or 8 years. So we're talking about a very slack economy with a lot of unemployed people, with very little ability to sort of push back about their working conditions, the decline of unions happening during this period. So most of these systems have been implemented in ways that serve only management objectives and have never even had to be put through their paces in terms of what the employee perspective might be. And, you know, as the economy picks up and the workforce tightens, there may be more pushback against these systems and more pressure on companies and on the third-party software providers to take into account employee needs in terms of both how they're designed and how they're implemented. But to date, that really hasn't been the situation. It's been a one-way street.
It's a huge issue as well for people who want or need to have a second job. If the restaurant you work at or whatever, the retail store, says they need you on call for a specific 40 hours in a week, but then only gives you 15 hours, you can't go get a second job.
Yeah, that's huge. I mean, we all know in recent years, with minimum wage not keeping pace with the cost of living, that is how low-wage workers work. I mean, a couple in a household might have 3 or even 4 or even 5 jobs between them to get all of their costs covered. So this trend, and it's a very recent trend, again, just in the last 5 years or so, to force everyone into this very precarious part-time situation where you have these scheduling systems saying, you know, we just need you for 3 hours on Tuesday during the rush, as opposed to giving you a full shift, or saying you have to be on call all day, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, just in case we need you, is creating a crisis in people just covering their rent.
Esther Kaplan is with us. She's editor of the Investigation Fund at the Nation Institute. Her article, The Spy Who Fired Me, The Human Costs of Workplace Monitoring, is the cover story in the March issue of Harper's Magazine. We'll come back to the conversation in a few minutes. The number is 1-800-933-5372 if you'd like to join us, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning. With classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules, applications are now being accepted for the program beginning April 6th. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the editor of the Investigation Fund at the Nation Institute, Esther Kaplan. She wrote the cover story for the March issue of Harper's Magazine called The Spy Who Fired Me, The Human Costs of Workplace Monitoring. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Esther, I was going along reading this article, being appalled at some of the things I read, but thinking at least people who are independent contractors, this is one thing they don't have to mess with. As it turns out, they're increasingly feeling pressured to use these tools on themselves to demonstrate their value to clients.
Yeah, again, this romance we have with technology, it seems to have no bounds. And so much of this is becoming so normal in our consumer life with the gadgets that we carry around that it becomes normalized in the workplace as well, where we aren't choosing it, where it's being imposed. But yes, the number of people doing freelance work in this country is steeply on the rise, whether it's in addition to that underpaid full-time job or as a full-time way to earn a living. And these online marketplaces have emerged, Odesk, Elance, serving more than 10 million freelancers who use them as ways to find clients beyond their kind of local network where they might in the past have been looking for work. This means that you can get hired by someone in Australia or someone in China or someone in the UK. And I think a lot of freelancers get involved with these marketplaces because it does expand their client reach so dramatically. And the leading one, Odesk, which I discuss in the piece, they offer this really nice thing, which is guaranteed payment. They take the credit card or of the client, the company, and if you log in through their online work diary, you are guaranteed that you will get payment for those hours. There's a dispute system if anyone disagrees about the work, but that's a really nice guarantee because freelancers spend a lot of time trying to get paid on their invoices. But the flip side is you're allowing that client that you've never met, who might be halfway around the world, to spy on your own computer in your own home.
Meaning they take screen grabs at random times sort of throughout a working hour, and whoever's hiring you can look at those anytime they want.
Yeah, exactly. Every 10 minutes at a random point, you cannot predict, a screen grab is taken. You know, if that happens to be the moment that you're on iTunes picking another song to listen to, or an instant message pops up from your boyfriend, that's captured and that's viewable by your client. And they also get, for every single minute you're on the computer, they get these metrics like number of keystrokes, number of mouse clicks, and so on. So they know a lot about what you're doing. And these are not just like tiny little thumbnails. They can see the image of your computer screen on their full computer screen and see everything that you have up on your desktop.
So you have the option, if you are one of these contractors, of saying, you know, I don't really want that email from my boyfriend to pop up. You can delete that, but then you lose income for that 10 minutes.
Exactly. So if that happens, and, you know, one Odesk freelancer I spoke with said that the somehow the algorithm has a knack for noticing when you're switching programs or something.
Right.
So he says it always seems to grab that snapshot when he's clicking a new playlist in iTunes or something like that. So you end up, you know, deleting a decent number of them in the course of the day, and you're in effect docking your pay by 10% every time you do it. And then there's all these other little things, like the very first 10 minutes that you're working and the very last 10 minutes, if you're not working the full 10-minute window, your activity meter might not look good. You get a green, yellow, or red on your activity meter, and a score of 1 to 10. You know, it's all turned into numbers. And so I talked to freelancers who would just delete those 10-minute increments as well. So then you're really starting to talk about, you know, maybe routinely a 20% pay cut or something. So that's a lot of time theft that I guess ostensibly these freelancers are choosing to do to themselves, but it's clear that the system is prompting that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Marlon in Dallas. Hello, Marlon.
Hey, how's it going?
Very well, thanks.
Good. Well, I just wanted to chime in on the conversation. The past 10 years of my life, I've worked for a lot of big companies, and they have all increasingly implemented these systems that she's talking about. The one in particular for a huge company, I'm not going to say, but everything up to the very minute from the time you got in to the time you left was documented. Bathroom breaks, holds for the calls that you took, everything. And it was something that really affected me at both of these places. It was really stressful, terrible experience.
Thanks so much for your call. You know, Marlon's call, Esther, makes me think, I mean, I get why companies feel like they want to know what everybody's doing and make sure that they are productive and active. And yet, on the other hand, we have so much emerging research that talks about the importance of autonomy in terms of creating employees who are loyal and productive. And particularly for knowledge work, the reality that, you know, thinking time and a little bit of freedom to take a break or change, you know, what you're looking at is actually really helpful for creativity.
Yeah, and I think that these two frames of thinking are kind of heading for a collision course right now. I think at the high end, the talent management systems that are targeting more elite workers are trying very hard to get buy-in from the workforce and make participation seem voluntary and consensual, and they have all these, you know, they talk a lot about the gamification of work, and you get to give your coworkers badges and get badges from them and post on each other's pages on these kind of what are called enterprise social platforms, kind of like a Facebook for the workplace. And, you know, they're really trying to make it imitate the consumer environment and make you participate as an active choice, but clearly it's not. And the measurements about your participation, everyone knows, are being collected and being fed into evaluations and decisions about raises and promotions and so on. So it's kind of a fake form of voluntary participation.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have David on the line next in Dallas. Hey, David.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a communications field engineer in electronics. My 40 years in this business, the people in my field have been very resistant to unionization. However, this kind of this kind of scenario has come up, and one of the things that would quickly switch us over to a unionized mindset would be this kind of ridiculous metricization of our jobs. We're a valuable commodity. We're skilled people. We have a work ethic, and we're hard to find. And if they don't think we're doing our job, then they need to find someone else. And good luck with that. So we're simply not going to tolerate being treated like children or criminals by people behind the desk who have no idea how our job really goes. So if they really, really want a big fight, then try and pull that in my industry. I can't speak to anybody else's, but mine will not tolerate it. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Anything you want to respond to there, Esther?
So I'm sorry, he said he was an electrician?
He works in communications technology.
Oh, communications technology. Yeah, well, I think that really highly skilled workers like our caller are going to be in the best position to be pushing back, and hopefully they'll help create some elbow room for other people down the line. As I said, I really do think that these systems have been developed and implemented in something of a vacuum because there just hasn't been a way for workers at a time of such economic insecurity to push back and question any of these or frankly quit if it's too oppressive. And, you know, again, maybe as the economy tightens, workplaces will begin to see more of this and will begin to be concerned again about retention issues, which they frankly have not had to prioritize in this super slack labor market.
It's interesting to think about productivity here because I suppose there are probably some gains in certain industries using certain technologies.
Sure.
On the other hand, there is no, you know, it sounds like there's a lot of gaming of the system. The moment these technologies are put in place, workers who find them untenable are finding ways around them.
Right. Well, that's what the scholars will tell you, that the minute you start setting up these really specific narrow measures that people have to meet, people will find a way to meet them. So you better be pretty smart about what those measures are because it might actually not have a lot to do with performing your job well. And yeah, the workarounds are a big part of this. I mean, when electronic monitoring was first pioneered in call centers and the people answering the calls, customer service calls or whatever, were given a time quota for each call, what did they start doing? They started hanging up in the middle of calls as soon as they hit the time quota because the monitoring system couldn't tell who'd terminated the call. You know, so that's a classic thing. Workers, yes, they will do their best to meet the expectations that are laid down. But if those expectations are centered narrowly around these metrics, it's really unclear. I mean, let me say some of these systems do provide some great gains. I mean, it's great to see telematics systems allowing companies to reduce fuel costs, to reduce maintenance costs. I mean, at a time of climate change, that's fantastic that these systems are going to be able to track idling time and reduce it and that kind of stuff. There are definitely some really bright spots in what these systems are capable of. But in terms of the impact on the workforce, it's right now it's the Wild West, and a lot of the pushback, the negative costs of this haven't been incorporated into process improvements yet.
We have time for one more call here if we are quick about it, and it's Newt in Plano. Hi, Newt. Newt, are you
with
us? Hi.
Yeah, my comment was simply I thought the woman captured it, but those enlightened companies that evaluate based on throughput, output, quality, and quantity are going to be far better off in the long run than those that measure every moment of a worker's life.
Esther, I'm guessing you don't disagree with that?
Well, I mean, again, I think that the people, the consultants out there who work with the more enlightened firms on how to implement these systems would say, look, the systems need to be improved so they have more subtle capacity to manage these various kinds of things. And the systems can be implemented in more forward-thinking ways. So I think the test in the years to come is whether that happens. And right now, I think the caller's correct that they're measuring things in such a limited way that it's warping everything from management priorities to the way employees try to meet those quotas. And, you know, as we discussed in retail and fast food, you know, really wreaking havoc on people's lives by sort of losing the human element in what management is.
And of course, this stuff is not cheap. You have to buy the software and the monitoring equipment, and then you have to train people to use it. Are people asking whether it's better to just pay for a few more employees on the job than to have the few that they have monitor all the time?
It's a really interesting question. Yeah, these systems are very expensive. Like in the retail systems, I found one estimate that it's between $200 and $400 per employee. So you can, with a lot of employees, that would add up very fast to north of $1 million. And with the telematics systems, you have to buy all that hardware, plus you're paying a service contract, and then the hardware might be obsolete in 4 years, and you have to do it all over again. So it's a tremendous investment, and I think companies are kind of barreling in there in the way that maybe they did at the dawn of the internet or something, like we've just got to be there because this is the future, but they haven't really thought through, in many cases, not in all, you know, thoughtfully how to implement this stuff and whether it's really worth it. I mean, UPS claims that it's worth it, but in a single year recently, they spent $100 million in their telematics implementation. And that's not just a one-time cost. They're spending giant sums of money each year on this. So it's got to start panning out for them in a pretty profound way to be worth that price tag.
Esther Kaplan is editor of the Investigation Fund at the Nation Institute. Her article, The Spy Who Fired Me, The Human Costs of Workplace Monitoring, is the cover story for the March issue of Harper's Magazine. Esther, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Well, thanks for your thoughtful conversation. It was great.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. And if you want to send the show an email, you can drop that to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.